I am shutting that off because that wasn't even very good. And that was exactly 7 o'clock. I don't know what song that was, but meh. So you are listening to Man vs. Mob Radio, and this is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. I am your host, Patrick Clerkin, and my in-studio guest tonight is an pretty old friend, Kush. Not old age-wise, but we've known each other for a while, for like...
68.
Oh, your mic is not working. This is a constant problem. Is it working now?
Can you hear me?
Nope, not at all.
Switch.
What about now?
Can you hear me?
Nope. You should switch to maybe this one or that one.
Oh, I can move this. Can you hear me now?
I still can't hear you.
That's
okay. Interesting. This is a different setup. Okay, this is a problem. One second. Damn it, somebody set this up differently. Okay. Well, I basically need to figure out how to switch over the profile to a different one because the mics aren't on, and that's bad. Check this out for a second, Kush.
What's up?
You see this monitor right here?
Let me come around.
Yeah, you come around. So,
yeah.
Right here, this is what I'm trying to get. What do you think I need to do to get that up? There's one.
To 4 mic plus aux?
Yeah, there's one mouse and it's not connected to that.
Does it go to. And none of these are used for this, right?
I don't believe so.
Okay, so let's see. What?
Maybe.
Yeah. What happens if you hit that?
That makes it pop up.
Try here. There we go.
Ooh, that worked.
Yep. And now I just need a select button. Oh, there we go. Okay, it's done.
That's done.
And 4 mics plus aux, is that the profile you wanted?
Yeah, 4 mics plus aux. Okay, so I think that'll work. I can already hear you.
Yeah.
You're a genius. Okay.
All right, sweet.
Thank you, Kush. Okay.
Wait, one of these headphones isn't working.
Does that work?
Yeah, this works.
Okay, cool.
Sweet.
All right, well, sorry about that, people. Technical difficulties, it happens. You are listening to Man vs. Mob Radio. Generally, it's better than 3 minutes of silence and fumbling around. My guest tonight... Oh, I'm your host, Patrick Clerkin. My guest tonight is Kush.
Hey,
and Kush. Okay, so I was just saying before that I wanted to start off reading a... I thought it was a pretty pertinent quote from something, and I wanted to get your impression of it. So some more fumbling around, and... All right. I think this is relevant to kind of our generation, what's going on right now. Maybe not just our generation, but let's say the 30 and under crowd. I think that's about right. All right. So it says, I have called the major crisis of adolescence the identity crisis. It occurs in that period of the life cycle when each youth must forge for himself some central perspective and direction, some working unity out of the effective remnants of his childhood and the hopes of his anticipated adulthood. He must detect some meaningful resemblance between what he has come to see in himself and what his sharpened awareness tells him others judge and expect him to be. In some people, in some classes, at some periods in history, the crisis will be minimal. In other people, classes, and periods, the crisis will be clearly marked off as a critical period, a kind of second birth, apt to be aggravated either by widespread neuroticisms or by pervasive ideological unrest. So, I know that's out of context, and that was a passage from a book written in 1963 called The Feminine Mystique, which was written by Betty Friedan, and I'm only about 100 pages into it, but it's basically, if you haven't heard of it, it's kind of like the main book of what you would probably call second wave feminism. It was this book describing how housewives felt trapped in their role as, you know, the caregiver, mother, have five babies or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that passage is really applicable to right now, how a lot of young people are just thinking to themselves, I'm following this path that isn't really my path that somebody else sort of defined for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that when it talked at the end about neuroticisms and ideologies, I think there's a lot of that going around right now. I mean, neuroticisms like anxiety and ideologies, all types of ideologies right now. Do you get any of that from it? Or I know that was...
I mean, I wasn't able to grab every single one of the lines in the passage, but from the parts that I understood, it also seems like it's kind of like the traditional method of, like, you build on what has been built before you and then you build past it. Mm-hmm. But then in the same way how you're building on something, you need to make sure that you are at least off that level or you go above it. Like, every kid, for example, wants to do better than their parents did. And obviously the parents want the same thing. Like, no parents just like, I want you to do worse than I did.
Yeah.
But I think that's just one of the most traditional ways of, like, how people view the people that come after them.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously disconnects that happen where, like, everyone thinks the other generation is more entitled or something along those lines. That's just how people are. But I think it's super applicable. But at the same time, it's also this other thing where you were talking about, like, neuroticisms and the incoming aspects of, like, anxiety, the incoming aspects of, like, depression that also come in. Not only are they more talked about as, like, actual, like, biological things that happen and no longer considered just, like, oh, you're having a mood kind of thing or along those lines. I think that's why we also hear a lot more about it, because it's not as demonized as it was before.
Yeah, the stigmas are kind of falling away, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's not even a universal thing yet, so we can't even say, like, the stigma's completely gone, because...
Oh, no, it's definitely not universal.
Like, I come from a more traditional culture. It definitely... Or not more traditional, but, like, a more ancient culture, and that definitely still has stigmatizations surrounding any sort of mental illness.
Sure. Can you explain that? Because, I mean, I know you, and... Sure.
No, that's perfectly fine. I'm like what you would call a third culture kid. Like, I was born in India, my parents are Indian, grew up in Dubai, and then I moved over here for college, and I've been here ever since. So, like, I've spent my life, like, majorly culturally confused.
Yeah.
And you always, like, hold on to certain things. Like, that's one of the reasons why people even when we were hanging out and someone would be like, oh, where are you from? I'm like, I don't particularly know how to answer this question. Like, where was I? Like, I still to this day tell people I'm born in India, grew up in Dubai, because that's the only way I can describe my cultural identity. Both of those cultures, however, do have a system where, like, not a system, but, like, almost like a popular belief or something along those lines where, like, depression.
We're getting a call right now. So let me attempt to... Sorry to cut you off.
No worries.
Just attempt to answer this.
Hello, caller. Can you hear me? Hey, how's it going? What's your comment or question? I can put you in on the air if you'd like to ask it live on the air. Oh, yeah, I think that I could probably step away for a minute or two and come back. So, yeah, I'll be right down. Yep, no problem.
Okay. Okay, so that was somebody calling to ask if I could let them in downstairs. So I need to step away for like, I don't know, 30 seconds. I'll be right back up. I am back, people. And you got cut off mid-sentence, and you were saying that you were, you basically have a whittled down version of what to say people when they ask you
where I'm from,
where you're from.
Yeah. And one of the things that's still to this day, like, where it's not, at times it's demonized, but it's also one of those things that's shunned aside. Like, you don't particularly address the fact that you're dealing with depression, or you're dealing with things, or you have like anything ranging from like high functioning to low functioning anxiety, or any sort of like day to day mental illness that someone might have to deal with, or just something like, you know, neuroticism. What was the word again?
Neuroticism. It's a tongue twister.
Yeah, yeah. I've also realized I'm suddenly having like a hard time saying certain words. Like,
you're having a stroke, maybe?
Like, consistently.
Okay.
But. That's one of the things where it's something that depends also like on a family by family basis. I feel like if you like as someone who's like a third culture kid, I think it's easier to talk about something like that. I think it's harder to bring that up if you come from a much more orthodox traditional family.
Absolutely.
And but I think that's also applicable to like different parts of the world, or like even different cultures, based on how exposed you are to everything else. I think that's another aspect that plays into like the same way how we view narrow-mindedness for certain parts of life, that can also apply to like how you view it on a, from a biological perspective as well. From a lot of different like aspects of life can come from how exposed you are to the rest of the world and how closed off you are.
Yeah, I think that somebody who hasn't lived in that environment of being closed off, or somebody who hasn't lived in the environment of being exposed, it's hard to visualize the other.
Yeah,
but it's pretty important. I think it's pretty interesting that you are basically a melting pot within a melting pot.
Yeah,
like, you live in a melting pot culture right now, and you yourself are a melting pot. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, like I can, like there are certain aspects of me that like, pretty not traditionally, but like the parts of me that like love identifying with my like the Indian culture that I have, and then there's other aspects of me as well where I'm like, I don't really connect with this aspect of like other people that I know that are Indian connect with. Like I just have no, I guess, like stake in it.
Yeah,
I like to say like the exact opposite is true when I would talk to my friends about who grew up over here, talk about like Disney original movies. And
you're lucky you didn't talk to me, because I had no idea what that was. We didn't have basic cable until I was like, I don't know, in middle school or something like that. So I missed out on the Disney originals.
So like, those were some of the things where I remember, like, I would talk to people that like viewed me as a movie buff or something like that, and then they would talk to me and they would bring up like these particular movies from like 2002, 2003, like mid 2000s kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was the movies that they watched growing up, because like Disney original movies, they would be free on air or something along those lines, and they'd be like, how would, did you not enjoy this, or other Disney original shows or certain shows like that. I'm like, I had no connection to any of those people in the show. Like,
yeah. What the hell are they even talking about?
Exactly. Like, there was no cultural identification for me. Like, I was.
Wait, how did you not identify with Lizzie McGuire?
That's like one of the things that people bring up. Like, I'm just like, I don't have anything that I can, like, I could watch it and it would be like an alien thing to me.
Yeah.
And it's not because, like, it has anything to do with, like, anyone's ethnicity or anything like that, but it's just a cultural difference that's there.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that, like, for me, my life jumped from watching, like, Cartoon Network shows to straight up watching, like, sitcoms and stuff like that. I didn't have, like, that middle part of, like, Disney originals or anything like that. Like, I was watching Cartoon Network pretty late into, like, my, I don't know, ones, like, basically, like, mm-hmm. 8, 9, 10, 11.
Yeah.
And then I just made an instant switch into, like, TV. Like, legitimate TV. And, like, that just plays into the account where, like, I never had an exposure to something like that. Like, Nickelodeon wasn't a massive thing growing up. Disney Originals weren't a massive thing. Like, I remember having a channel called E! Junior, which was, like, Arthur and a few other things.
Oh, yeah, those ones.
And, yeah, those are, like, the identifying moments until I got, like, Cartoon Network and got more into, like, you know, anything ranging from like Ben 10 to Megas XLR to like Courage the Cowardly Dog, all of these different cartoons. But like,
oh yeah, like I liked Courage the Cowardly Dog and Ed and Eddie. My mom said that I was gonna, well, I can't say exactly what she, maybe I only remember it this way. I don't think she actually ever said it, but yeah. I think she was like, you're gonna basically grow up to be like brain damaged if you watch this show. And she might be right.
But the Ed, Ed and Eddie and SpongeBob are the two shows where I get the most amount of flack because I always say that I never enjoyed those shows. Those were shows that I could not get into.
Yeah.
They like physically aggravated me while I watched the show.
Yeah, understandable.
So like those are the two shows where like I'll talk to people about and they're just like, how do you not like this? This is like so up your alley. And I'm just like, sometimes something's just way too stupid to have fun with.
Yep. I remember that, well, I mean, when one of the main characters of a television show it is constantly saying the same thing about a plank of wood, then you're dealing with maybe not highbrow content. I just wanted to say, because jumping back a couple, like a minute or two, you were saying about how you sort of, some things you identify with Indian culture, some things you don't, and it's sort of like you're a fusion. And I think that's probably pretty liberating to be able to just kind of cherry pick the aspects that you like.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, isn't that kind of cool in a way?
It does.
Maybe it's confusing, but it also seems, maybe you didn't realize it at the time, maybe you don't think about it this way, but to me, from an outsider's perspective, that seems kind of cool to just sort of like merge two things and kind of pick, but maybe you didn't have that.
100%. Like, I there are parts of me that if someone's just like, how do you not know this? Like, I can't read or write Hindi. I can just speak it. Mm-hmm. That's like one thing where even though I kind of learned it a little bit in like elementary school and everything like that, but that's like a cultural identity of mine where like I'm just like, I grew up learning French.
Yeah.
As opposed to Hindi, which was like the weird thing for me. Like French and Arabic were the two main languages that I learned throughout school. And
that sounds terrible. I had to take Spanish, which is a relatively easy language, and I was just a little piece of trash in that class. I was such
basura? Yeah, I think that's
yeah, a little basura.
But no, like those are some of the things. But yeah, I definitely like did, for lack of a better word, like cherry pick the parts of me that I like to identify with, like either festivals, food, the good Bollywood movies that come out every once every 3 years.
Oh man, those are like, hilarious. At least some of the clips that I've seen.
Yeah.
Of like the horse, the guy turning sideways and sliding under the truck on his horse.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I do pick like the parts that I think are the best and I'm like, that's part of my cultural identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that also kind of plays into the fact that like I come from a somewhat religious family, but at the same time, like I had the entire like freedom to like interact and mix with every single culture that I came into contact with. Like I went to a high school that had, I think they used to say like during meetings that like close to like 84 different nationalities in our high school.
That's nuts.
So like it was pretty normal to like just come across someone else from a different part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You hang out with them, you go to their family's house, you get to have their food, they talk to you about their own culture.
Mm.
And it wasn't like, oh, I'm getting to learn this new thing, but it was more of like, this is just normal. Like, you just like I grew up like, okay, my like one of my friends is Lebanese, the other one's from like a different part of the world. Mm-hmm. I have a friend from like I think of Brazil and like a few other places. So like it was pretty normal to have like multicultural friend group, multicultural background, like, and that way I think you kind of also realize like you also cherry pick from like each other's cultures and kind of pick like what you want to identify with their culture as well.
That's cool, and I think that's important because a lot of people, I believe, particularly Americans, think that the U.S. is the only place that is like that or has been like that, you know, where you have those cultures forced together and interacting in different ways. So it's good to hear things like that.
Look, I'd say like every single modern city that has become a financial hub is a center of something like that, because that's one of the things where like, it's like a weird thing to say, but like finance is something that like brings in people from all different walks of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that ends up being like they bring in their families and these families then interact. So if you look at Dubai, you look at Singapore, you look at like a few other like minute cities in the world, it's pretty common for there to be like a multicultural thing that just exists. Like you just grew up with people from, you could come from like any part of the world and then you would have this like weird like almost like a Middle Eastern twang to the way that you spoke if you went to Dubai and you spoke English over there. And if it also depended on what kind of school you went to, because if you went to a more British school like I did, you would like turn like end up having like a, almost like an anglicized accent. But if you went to one of the more like almost like a heavily Middle Eastern school, then you would have a more of a Middle Eastern twang to the way that you spoke English.
And it must have been hard to keep track of.
I've had absolute, like if you look at the last like 15 years of my life, my accent's gone like a complete 180 from what I used to have. Like I grew up speaking with an Indian accent, then I had more of a British accent, to then I had like more of an like American accent, and now it's like it's kind of
the man with 100 identities.
I think that's one of the things where you can, it can also lead you down a path where, and I try to stray away from this as much as I can, is having a different like version of me when I interact with different people. I think that's something I also kind of judge of other like same kind of like story Indian people that I come across, where they have an identity that's there with their college friends, and then they have an identity that's there when they're interacting with their parents, when they're interacting with other family members.
Do you see that as two-faced?
I see that as very two-faced. I see that as like the entire thing of that would be like to hide a part of your life from your parents because you think that they're gonna disregard it. I think that also kind of falls into this category of like parents possibly suppressing their kids a lot, like limiting what they can do and what they cannot do, which leads to an
setting
entire
limits.
Exactly. And like I had like my limit was just like, don't do anything illegal, don't do anything stupid, and like just be safe about the decisions that you make in life. And I think
it's a pretty singular and I would imagine tough to define on a daily basis limit.
But that's how you kind of realize what's good for you to a certain extent and what's not. If you do something stupid, then like my parents would come in and be like, you did something stupid. Don't do this again. And I think like that's kind of an important part of parenting kids to a certain extent as well, is like, especially if you're, the more like someone gets suppressed, the more likely they are to springboard the moment they get any sort of freedom.
They explode. It's like one of those weird creatures that comes up from the bottom of the ocean and like explodes basically, because it's like instant depressurization. I mean, what do you think happens to most of us when we go to college for the first time, if we're fortunate enough to go to college? It's like, what? Alcohol? Sex? All these things happening around me, and now I don't have parental oversight anymore. I'm gonna go nuts, and then you end up like with all these burnouts.
But like that's another one of those things where like then you end up reaching this point where you almost feel ashamed for doing the things that you do, or you feel like you can't tell your parents about the things that you do, and you lead these two different lives, and like that not only exists for someone who's my age, but I've seen that happen with people that are like 7, 8, 9 years older than me.
Yeah, I mean, I completely understand what you're talking about, and I've tried to parse and reconcile this myself, where I, on one side, see that having completely different, for me, two-faced is more like if you are friendly to somebody's face, and then you, behind their backs, you're like, oh yeah, that person sucks, and you talk trash about them or whatever, and I think there's like, there's more of a natural difference, I think, between like the way you would act in front of some of your peers and like your grandparents, like the crudeness of the things that you would talk about. You either have to limit yourself to be like wholesome 24/7 if you're going to be like the person that you're with your grandparents, which I think is like an extremely difficult and smothering standard, or you have to be different, or you have to be like crude with your grandparents and as you are with your friends, or you just have to be like, well, obviously there's like each audience is going to prefer a different,
like, no, there's 100% no one in this world who's like the exact same in every single or in every circumstance. Like, you have to have like a work version of you, there's a home version of you, there's like a party version of you, and if you like mesh those three things, then at times it just goes like haywire. And
exactly, like, oh, it's like mixing chemicals.
Exactly. But like there's also an aspect of like absolutely lying,
yes,
and kind of just being like, I never did this, I never do these kinds of things.
Oh yeah, like multiple personality, whatever it's called, that condition. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, like almost like a which makes it like, I don't know, that's what I kind of view it as, like more of a two-faced kind of thing, like having these like two different versions of you, not in the same way like how you would have like a work and a home version of you, but more of like an absolute different person. Like just like the other part of you, all of the things that you do don't really exist when you're the other person.
Particularly the value structure. I would say that's the biggest thing. It's like if you have different values, or your values just go away when you're with, you know, your peers versus when you're with people who you feel like view you another way. I mean, this whole endeavor that I'm doing right now with the podcast and the radio program, that's actually one of the things that to me was saying, how can I collapse all of these? I mean, not that they were too different from each other to begin with, but like, how can I converge all these identities into one so that I'm basically like, you know, my parents, my my peers, my neighbors, my relatives, people who don't know me, people who I've worked with, everybody sees sort of the same thing, basically, or close to the same thing. And there's going to be awkwardness in that, and that some people are like, oh, I didn't know that you were like this in this way, or that you were interested in that thing, or, you know, there. I think everybody is adapting a little bit, but it's, I want everybody to be able to do that a bit. And I think that we're moving towards that when it comes to people being able to be more of fully who they actually are and breaking down these walls, particularly in some of these job cultures where previously it was like very, very rigid walls of what you don't bring any of yourself to the workplace. So
like, it's almost like the moment you walk through those doors, like you have to be an entirely different person. It's not you anymore.
Yeah.
And obviously that also led to like, I mean, that also used to happen at a time when like there was way more job loyalty, which is a weird thing to say, that like having a fake personality meant that you would stay in a job longer, but not because it was like almost like a mutual thing where like the company was just like, you're not going to know all of the shady stuff that we do. And when you come into our workplace, you're not going to do any of the shady stuff that you do.
Pretty much. Like, I mean, you were an automaton, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in the age before robots and automation, there were people who were basically being used as automatons who either were being used for the same task repetitively and also were, you know, if you worked in a more white collar type profession, probably you were being forced to like subdue your personality or anything that gave you individuality.
Yeah. Like almost like all, weirdly enough, like industries that came out in the 90s, industries that came out post industrial revolution, post like into more of the service revolution, are still more likely to be traditional in the way that they want you to behave in a workplace. And like, it's, there's always been a split where like they realize that the more freedom you give to your employees, the more likely they are to stay with you, the more likely they are to like, I guess, open up.
Yeah.
And
probably abuse it too though, right?
Yeah, that's another thing.
It's like a lot of abuse and then a lot of loyalty.
But that's the entire point of like, that's just freedom.
Yeah.
Freedom and
that's the nature of freedom.
Yeah, like the more you restrict something, the more likely there is to be a revolution. The more you like open up to freedom, the more likely there is to be like the both the good and the bad of it. It's just weighing whether you want to be like an autonomy or not even an autonomy,
a
dictatorship, basically like autocratic area, or whether you want to be more of like a democratic institution or something along those lines.
I see that. I see what you mean. It's you can't really define your rules and your expectations mm-hmm. based off of the people who are going to be the exceptions who are going to break the rules.
Yeah.
In some cases, I guess, but in most, you shouldn't. It just dawned on me that, so half hour's gone by in the okay. program, and I never brought up that please call in to the studio if you have a comment or a request or suggestion, anything. If you want to say, hey, that 3 minutes at the beginning where you're just fumbling around like an idiot, I didn't appreciate that. You know, I can take a criticism. So the studio line is 855-915-9636. Once again, 855-915-9636. If you can't remember those last four digits, it's actually WMFO. If you can't remember the three digits before that, then I can't help you.
Google.
Yeah, Google. Go to WMFO.org if you forget. If you don't remember WMFO, then once again, there's only so much I could do. So you're listening to Man vs. Mob Radio, and I'm your host, Patrick Clerkin, and I've been in the studio talking with Kush. And so let's... do the PSA.
Yeah, let's do the PSA.
You picked an interesting one.
Should I just read?
Yeah, all right. Just read that thing.
So, I got a pretty cool PSA over here. It's called The Walking is Good Exercise PSA.
With a cool little photo, huh?
The really, really, like, high-quality animation.
That looks like that was a badly designed meme. An anime meme. Anyway, all right, I'll stop interrupting.
All right, although other physical activities can provide a more vigorous workout, walking is easy, requires no special equipment, and is a good exercise for most adults. In urban areas, walking can be an excellent alternative to driving or even taking public transportation. For example, it's just a little over 2.5 miles from the Tufts campus in Medford to Harvard Square in Cambridge, a distance that can be walked in about 45 minutes by a healthy adult. Walking can get you fresh air, exercise, burn calories, save you money, and with all the inattentive and otherwise impaired drivers on the road, it's safer than riding a bike. A public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Community Radio.
Very good. All right. Yeah, walking is good. Let's keep that in mind. Baby steps, people. Just if you're inactive and you you know, you want to get more healthy, start off just walking. It's good. I mean,
that was one of the biggest things about Pokemon Go, like, what, 3.5 years ago.
People started
walking.
Okay, so we got to explain Pokemon Go. We don't know who's listening. So Pokemon Go was an augmented reality game, right?
It was
so,
one of the biggest forays in AR gaming, where like you got to walk around to different parts of the city, the country, wherever you were living, and catch Pokemons. And when you walked to like different parts of the city, or you like kind of drove and then started walking or something along those lines, you got to walk enough to catch different Pokemons. You got enough to like rotate Pokestops that gave you like eggs and potions and stuff like that. And then you had to walk to crack those eggs, because you would get like 3 kilometers, 5 kilometers, 10 kilometer long eggs. And once you finished walking that, it just gave you like a unique Pokemon.
So the controversy with Pokemon Go was that people were like walking into traffic and doing inattentive things. People were walking into like sacred places and doing disrespectful things, and that people were basically being incentivized to go outside using their phones. So like, you know, they would go on a nature walk in places where people were trying to enjoy nature, and they'd be like, oh wow, I found a Charizard under this rock.
So one of the things, like, I do get a level of criticism that came for it, but at the same time, it did encourage people to like just go out.
Yeah, no, I'm in support of that.
Yeah, and I love that idea. Like it gave people something to connect on. Like there were stories of like people connecting with like their grandparents, because like it was a pretty easy to use game. Mm-hmm. So you know, like kids would go on walks with their grandparents and like play the game, and then just like grandparents started getting addicted to it, and that was a bit of a problem. But like,
hey, I'm with you. Like, I think it's stupid to have this attitude of, oh, it's people won't go outside, that's so annoying, and then people go outside and it's not in the way that you want them to go outside. It's like, okay, there's a transition. Like, you know, maybe the Pokemon Go game leads them outside, and then they start going outside without the Pokemon Go game after a while, because they go, oh wow, I never had this appreciation for nature before, or going on walks.
I mean, it also works out pretty well in certain cases where, like, I would go back home, I used to live, like, kind of far out of the city. Not far out of the city, but just outside the city. And and Dubai was a place where, like, Pokemon Go was there in the city, but it didn't really expand out of the city.
Yeah.
And what I would do was, like, I would drive to my gym, I would work out over there, and then I would go on like a 45 minute long walk because my gym was in like downtown area.
That's smart.
And then I would just catch Pokemons around that area, then drive back home. And then later on in the night when it wasn't like 120 degrees, I would go for a bike ride or a walk, and then I would crack the eggs that I got earlier on in the afternoon.
That's pretty cool. That sounds like a good routine.
Yeah. And like, I didn't have much to do in the summer because like it's super hot in Dubai.
Yeah.
But like, it kind of like lets you do this kind of a thing, and it's kind of useful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like to a certain extent, like if you're like kind of normal and smart about it, it's a pretty like safe thing to do.
Yeah.
Like, you're not hurting anyone, you're not hurting yourself. Like, don't go onto private property. Walk like you would any other time. Like, watch the traffic and everything.
Don't
like
just like what we were saying before, don't build the rules off of the exceptions. Like, exactly. There's always going to be people who are doing some idiotic thing,
and that's never going to stop even with implementing those rules. Like, Pokemon Go, after like 4 or 5 months after it being out, started giving you a notification every time you open the app, just being like, watch the roads and don't walk onto private property. Doesn't mean it stops anyone. It's not like they put like a shock collar around you, and if you like didn't follow the rules, they're like buzz. Like,
yeah, you don't ban cameras because somebody decides to try to do Frogger across the freeway. So I wanted to, and you know, I'm sure that I've brought this up on a previous radio broadcast or a previous podcast episode, but I just love this topic. So this is related to walking. Really more related to running, I'd say, but like, I am just fascinated by the number of different gaits that people have when they run or walk, you know, the different styles. For such a simple thing, you know, it's like breathing for me. I think of running or walking as being like, okay, one foot in front of the other, your arms do sort of like a natural thing. Nope, not so. You see people, like, do you ever people watch near a reservoir or a body of water that people exercise around? It's crazy. People do the velociraptor where they have their arms going like this with the little talons, and then you have people swaying side to side like some sort of weird bobblehead thing.
But those are more of like the brisk walking techniques.
But not really, because like, you see some people? I've seen people brisk walk and power walk, but I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about people really.
I've seen people run in weird ways, but I've never seen anyone run with the talons out, kind of thing. Like, that's.
Oh well, I mean, like, okay. This is, some of this was from high school during track, but I've actually seen these things out in the real world. Yep. It's startling. Yeah, when you're watching people.
I mean, I'd say like, it's one of those things where, like, when people are running, one of the biggest things that they want to do is, like, you're going to be doing a strenuous activity, so you want to do it in the most comfortable way possible.
Yeah.
And if you try to do, like, aesthetically pleasing running, it's probably not going to get you what you want to do.
That's true. Yeah, there are different body types, and they're different, you know, everybody's bone structure and muscle structure is different. Yeah, and then have you ever had the situation where somebody points out that something basic that you've been doing, like, all your life is wrong, or... I always use the golf swing example where somebody says, oh, you know, a golf swing's easy. All you have to do is tilt your head at this angle and move your hips at this angle and move the club at this speed and this angle and that. And then you're focusing on like 19 different things and then you just look like an idiot.
So I trained in archery for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I realized, no joke, like halfway into my training was that I was using the wrong eye to like see down the sight, and they were, and I was hitting bullseyes. Like, I was getting,
oh, you were doing well.
I was doing incredibly well. Like, I was gonna start training for a competition, and I would go for like intercollegiate competitions for this was when I was like living in Dublin. And that's when I was like talking with the coach and like the head coach, and we were kind of just like going through it. One of them looked at which eye I was closing and which I was keeping open, and he's just like, you're using the wrong eye to aim.
So did you go through the steps of learning or using the right eye and get worse, or did you just plow ahead with the way you were doing it?
I did both. Like, I would switch over to the right eye. Like, I kept trying to switch over to the right eye, and it eventually went through. But there were also times where I'm just like, I can't do this. Like, when you have to do the instant shift, it's like someone asking you to like go from like, oh yeah, you're like an orthodox boxer, change to southpaw right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of one of the things that happened to me with this was like, I used to shut off my right eye and I used to like aim for my right side. So I was using my left eye to like follow the arrow.
Well, hey, that's pretty impressive. So you went the more difficult way and you figured out how to do that.
Which is the way I used to aim.
Accidentally.
Oh, yeah. And that's like one of those things where like I just used to, I did it the completely the wrong way. And it reminds me of that meme where it's just like, you used the complete wrong formula, but you somehow got the right answer. And I don't know how.
My history with archery isn't a very grand one. I used Mike Lucarello's recurve bow, and this was off of the back deck in New Jersey, and I did one pull and let it go, and it smacked into my forearm, gave me a welt like.
And I'm gonna get. Did you have the arm guard or?
No, I did not have the arm guard, and Mike was just like, "Wow, I didn't even know somebody could do that." So yeah, I got really effed up on my arm, and I was like, "No, I'm good. I'm not gonna do another one of those."
I grew up like weirdly fascinated by archery, and like I kind of did before I did it like during college years. The last time I had like kind of done archery was like I was like maybe 3 years old, and I had like a wooden bow and arrow, and I used to love doing it. And it's like I grew up watching Lord of the Rings, and one of my favorite characters the entire time was Legolas, and then it was the same thing with like other. Like I was just fascinated by archery, so I got to do it, but then I realized the entire time I was doing it wrong.
That's a bit discouraging, I have to say.
But it was still pretty fun. Like, but yeah, it's like one of those things where you realize like you're doing what you're doing entirely the wrong way.
I think I would only really consider getting into archery if I was going to go the full mile of, if I was going to become a falconer and operate on the steppes of Mongolia, longbow. That's what I would, screw modern bow technology.
What were those bows called? I'm trying to remember, like the ones that were used.
Is it like a nut bottle? The really, really old ones?
No, it was used by like Genghis Khan's army. There were these like gigantic bows.
Oh.
And each of the like the arrows used to weigh like how much like a heavy arrow would weigh, but these bows used to be
so like the one in Smaug in the Hobbit movie where they shoot those harpoon.
Crossbows or like kind of like a harpoon kind of thing. These were bows that were like 6 feet tall, almost
probably a longbow, and that's like the least sophisticated bow, and you can make them really the pull on them, you get no assist.
I like they were called longbows, but they had a specific name to them, and the reason behind it was
compound.
It wasn't even a compound bow because compound bows are pretty modern.
Yeah.
These were just like very old school longbows, but because of the sheer size of them, they used to be used by cavalry riders when they were just on the horse. And then they would like kind of like tack it to the horse and then use the bow and arrow and then shoot these like incredibly long distances into. And that's what made them like incredibly hard to beat as well when you had a cavalry charge, but they were able to use ranged attacks.
Yeah, I mean, like anytime anybody has a conversation about modern masculinity and what it should be, like, I'm just not worthy of anything that happened of back when people were shooting bows from horseback. Like I've come to terms with that. People are like, oh no, this is what masculinity is. I was like, no, I'm pretty sure it like peaked 1,000 years ago, and we're playing a kid's version of it now.
The requirements of life are also very different. Like,
of course,
brains are what brought us here to a certain extent. Like,
no, like, I'm not even making a claim about it. I'm just like riffing. I just think
but it definitely like we have like physically we have a much more comforting life than people that came in before us, 100%.
Yeah.
But
so when people talk about like recapturing that now, I'm like, yeah, go get good luck.
It's also, what's
go
the
get
point?
Your horse and your bow.
You could, I mean, it's going to go down a whole other path. Which
I think it could be. Let's just end it with this. I think it could be funny watching some men get on horseback and shoot arrows at like Ubers in Boston. Oh yeah, my Uber's stuck in traffic. Sorry, there's a guy on horseback firing arrows at us.
Didn't it happen in New York recently where like because of the conflict between Uber and the general like taxi union, they just like shut down.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. I would not be surprised.
It's an interesting life.
So we could recommend that. Was it Bill de Blasio or whatever? He'd be like, well, we should have a cavalcade of archers.
Like the cabs like block out the road, and right behind the cabs are all these people on horses.
Like people with shields in the front. What the hell is going on? It's a weird merge of history. Okay.
History and unions. There we go.
All right. So The next thing is, you were talking about Mandalorian before. I was talking about South Park, and you should talk Mandalorian.
Okay. I mean, I have a really quick spiel about the Mandalorian. Mm-hmm. I think it's...
Oh, wait, all right. First, explain, like, Mandalorian. For those who don't know, what is Mandalorian?
Mandalorian is basically story about a bounty hunter. Takes place after Episode 6 in the Star Wars universe, so, like, post-Return of the Jedi. And it's just this, like, still takes place in the outer parts of the galaxy, so it's not really central to all of the storylines that happen with, like, the Skywalker lineage and everything like that. But it's just this, the Star Wars Western. Like, it's by far one of the best Westerns, like, that we've seen recently. And weirdly enough, it's in the Star Wars universe.
Hmm.
And the best way that I like to put it is, like, if you took the person that made Iron Man, who was in charge of the Mandalorian, and he wanted to make something as a tribute to Sergio Leone and, like, the character of, like, you know, the man with no name. That's what the Mandalorian basically is. And people, like, it's the first four episodes are universally, like, just applauded, and everyone's like, this is fantastic. But that's where you kind of realize that, like, people aren't accustomed to the kind of TV show that Jon Favreau wants, and Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni want the Mandalorian to be, which is, they don't want it to be like an episodic thing, or not like a something that, like, you know, just spans like a massive storyline and everything like that, which is what the Star Wars stories are.
What's it called when it's like a couple episodes a season? Is is it an anthology?
Yeah, it's almost like an anthology series where, like, all of the episodes tie into each other, and there's almost like a South Park thing where, like, there's one factor that holds the entire season together.
There's an arc, and then it's like each arc can kind of connect to the next arc.
Yeah, like there's like almost like a tree, like, trunk or something like that, and then this branch is open.
That's okay. There's like a fiber going between each one, though, right? Where
exactly.
It's like, you know, they're callbacks and things like that, but they're not central and essential.
Yeah, and like each of the episodes is a branch coming off of it, and that's where you realize where people are just like, look, this show's pointless, but, like, the entire thing of it is that it's not meant to be this, like, bombastic show. It's just a story about, like, one person with a supplementary character kind of going about what life would be like if they didn't do a particular thing. And I think it's, cinematography is gorgeous, and they also, like, took out heavy aspects of CGI are all taken out, which I'm not someone who hates on CGI, but it's just lovely to see, like, them using, like, these, like, traditional figures and then using different camera angles and, like, playing around with the cameras to kind of make these figures look massive or look small and everything like that. So it's very traditional to old school Star Wars in those ways. But then again, there are episodes where, like, I like to remember, I think the second episode, there was no line of dialogue for the first 9 minutes. And these are 35 minute long episodes. So they're not, like, long episodes. It's just very, very visually driven. And at the same time, just, it's a lot of the stories just told through actions and emotions and everything like that. And it's rare to see something like that now.
Is it gritty?
It is very gritty, yeah.
Okay.
It is.
I feel like it's hard to have content that isn't gritty now. Gritty's a favorite.
Yeah, like, it is definitely pretty, like, it's realistic. Like, even though when you watch the Mandalorian fight, he's not like this, like, there's a cartoon version of the Mandalorians, which you could watch on, like, the Clone Wars or all of these other TV shows where he's just, like, flying robotic, like, fighters.
Yeah.
But this one's, like, way more grounded. It's way more of just, he's wearing a steel made of armor made of steel. It's going to be incredibly heavy on a human body.
Yeah.
So you can't fly around and, like, kind of, like, do acrobatic stuff.
And you got the physics people to work with all the time. It's got to be such a buzzkill if you're trying to produce something creative. People are like, actually, the comic book guy from The Simpsons.
Yeah. It weighs like 130 pounds. You won't be able to jump the entire time.
I'm glad to hear that there's more to The Mandalorian than Baby Yoda, because one would think that's the only part of the entire show.
Baby Yoda's like minions for millennials.
Okay.
That's a good way of putting it. Like,
weren't minions for millennials?
I think minions were a bigger hit among like people in their 50s, because
that's true. Well, and college chicks who don't have anything to wear
for,
on,
like,
Halloween. Yeah.
I don't think I saw a lot of people dressed up as minions.
Oh, I did over the last couple of years.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's kind of the new phoning it in cat whiskers and ears, you know?
Just getting a Minion costume and calling it all. Like, just,
yeah.
Like a t-shirt, glasses, and then you're good
to go. Some overalls and then some goggles. Yeah, pretty much.
Could be a Minion, could be a character from Mad Max. You'd never know.
That's a good point.
But yeah, you wanted to talk about newer season. Oh, sorry.
Well, before we go to South Park, I mean, I think that it's, you were talking about The Mandalorian and, mm-hmm. and it's kind of experimental anthology style plot mm-hmm. and how it's, I don't know, maybe not unusual for today's standards, but maybe unusual for the Star Wars universe. Go ahead.
Like, no, it's one of those things where, like, if you take into account just the Star Wars movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's 1977, so we're talking about 42 years, about to be 43 years, mm-hmm. all to do with, like, one family. So it's such a strong story that's been put together across all of these movies.
Yeah.
Whereas The Mandalorian feels very disjointed, but it's not the fact that it's disjointed. You just have one central character, one person who, like, everything is being told through.
Yeah.
And it's just day-to-day or, like, week-to-week occurrences of, like, what's happening in this person's life by his previous actions impacting his current actions.
Okay. Don't a lot of people think that the new movies are a big misstep and that this is kind of a return to a good course? Or did I just make that up?
No. You're not wrong. Like, a lot of people do hate the new movies.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people do think that, like, that's what people, when they watch the first few episodes
yeah.
of The Mandalorian, were just like, oh, this is, like, true Star Wars.
Whoa, okay, so is it kind of like this, where it's like, okay, so you've got, say you're a parent, and you've got a bunch of kids, and you're like, well, a couple of those kids are, I can't say it on the radio, S-heads, but they're my kids, so I love them anyway. That's kind of like the vibe I'm getting with the new Star Wars movies, where a lot of people see the Star Wars movies, where they're like, yeah, they're not very good, but it's Star Wars. Like, I love Star Wars. I grew up with Star Wars, so I'm going to see any type of Star Wars if it comes out.
So I think Star Wars is one of those things, like, this is coming from someone who's been a Star Wars fan my entire life,
mm-hmm.
like, basically my entire conscious life. Star Wars is one of those things where there's a lot of purists to it.
Yeah.
And
I definitely noticed that.
And it's very confusing, because if you do the exact same thing that happened previously, people hate it,
mm-hmm.
and they want you to go, like, you know, be more
creative. Why aren't you creative and original?
And when you're creative and original, people hate it,
mm-hmm.
because you're like, wow,
this you deviated from the plot too
exactly.
much.
Exactly. And that leads...
The source material.
And that leads to a point where you're just like, what on earth's happening? And it's the same thing which happens with, like you can't please anyone, because people...
You can please, like, 50% of the people. You can't please everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not 50%. Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, like, you can please people. You just can't please everyone at once.
Yeah. And, like, Star Wars has always been that thing where, like, everyone loved Episode 4 when they watched it. Like, all these people that were Star Wars fans.
Mm-hmm.
And then they watched Episode 5 and loved it more. And then Episode 6 came out, and then that's when people started deviating away, where they were like, Return of the Jedi was not true Star Wars.
Oh.
And then the prequels came by.
The purists.
It's like one of those things where they're just like, Disney took it away from George Lucas.
Yeah.
And Disney messed it all up. However, when George Lucas was in charge of Episodes 1, 2, and 3 and solely did it by himself, everyone was just like, oh, he's gone insane. This is terrible.
Should call those people Star Wars Nazis.
That's actually...
They're purists.
Kind of, yeah, no, like...
Just like the Nazis.
That's kind of a term that gets used also. Like,
yeah.
It's just... the one thing that, like, is really hard for anyone who's, like, a big fan of a particular thing is that the story isn't theirs.
Mm-hmm.
The story is in the hand of the storyteller.
Yeah.
And you can't ever say that this is the right way for the story to go.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't get to say that unless you are the storyteller. You can react to it,
yeah.
but you can't dictate it.
Yeah, I like that.
And I think that's always going to be the case with, like, whether you're looking at Star Wars, whether you're looking at Game of Thrones, whether you're looking at anything that built off a massive fan base.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, you can be like, this was wrong and they shouldn't have done this. But you can't be like, this is not the right story, or this is not the true story, because you're not the storyteller.
People are still going to try.
Oh,
well, I mean, like, I'm a huge fan of the modern concept of, like, open sourcing things mm-hmm. and collaborating and sort of, like, taking people's input and mm-hmm. and using that to sort of, like, morph. But at the same time, when people, like, after the fact, when you've created something and mm-hmm. people are like, well, actually, I think, and you're just kind of like, yes, TFU, I appreciate it, but, like, people need to realize there's a difference between creating and criticizing, and there's an importance to criticizing, but it's much easier to criticize than to create, and you should have experience creating to give you an appreciation of criticizing. It's this, maybe I should have said the reverse, but basically it's the same thing as, like, you know, you should work at a restaurant at some point to know that when you're bitching out the waiter, that you are, like, you need to know what that's like from the receiving end to know that you shouldn't be doing that. Okay. I just wanted to, I'm going to sacrifice the South Park thing. I wanted to tie in what I was thinking about The Mandalorian kind of back to the beginning of the episode and something that we've talked about before.
Sure.
So it sounds like that interesting setup, that interesting style of The Mandalorian, where it's more what's the term we were using before, when it's like anthology, more anthology like and a little experimental. It sounds like I really like this era that we're living in of experimentation with structure, with of stories and different styles and everything like that, and not a lot of people like that, but I think that. So we talked about this in an earlier podcast that we recorded, like, I don't know, back in August or July or something like that, which I'm yet to release. I'm going through it all. All right. So it's coming. But so we were talking about structure and how you have a lot of anti-heroes now. Yeah. And so, you know, series like Breaking Bad and Sopranos and Game of Thrones, you have people, you have confusing perspectives and time leaps and unreliable narrators, and I mean the new Joker movie, unreliable narration and non-linearity and all these different experimentation techniques. And I think it's really sort of seeping out into, jumping back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the episode, the way that people kind of lead their lives. It's they don't necessarily see their own lives, and maybe we're just at the beginning of this, but they don't necessarily see their own lives and the general truth of the world in such a linear matter anymore. Like, it's, you know, there are steps forward and backward and left and right, and it's more of a maze. It can be confusing and rewarding, that figuring it out. So I think that people have started to, I don't know whether it's an example of life imitating art or art imitating life, but I see people starting to, you know, deviate from these, like, set prescribed paths that used to be the thing that everybody was doing, right?
Like, film at the end of the day is going to be art. And that's why, one of the reasons why, like, I don't subscribe to an idea that, like, film needs to be a certain kind of thing in order to be considered a film. I hate the idea of, like, when people are just like, streaming services aren't film. Hated the idea of people, like, any sort of gatekeeping that goes onto film as to what a film is in its entirety wrong.
Like the recent comments by Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, that, like, Marvel movies aren't film, or Marvel movies aren't traditional cinema, or anything along those lines. Because art never stays the exact same. If we subscribe to an idea that something needs to be a particular type of thing, we would still only be doing, like, cave paintings, because at one point that was art, now it's kids drawings, but that was still considered art. And that's one of the things where, like, I can't get on board with an idea of, like, you know, one of the things that, like, they teach you when you're getting, like, a film degree or you're in film school or anything along those lines, is that there are certain ways to write a script, and then there's certain ways to make a movie or something along those lines. And obviously this is slowly changing, where you have classes where they tell you, like, this is how it was done. It's no longer the same thing.
Yeah.
But that is exactly that's not how art works. Like, you can't manufacture it. And that's one of the reasons
people think you can.
But that's what I was going to get to, was, like, when you were talking about, like, open sourcing ideas and kind of, like, taking in what everyone else says, and that's when you get to a point where you're trying to create, like, a product that's going to appease everyone.
And Justice League. You have to decide from all of those comments which, based on your principles, are worthwhile comments and considerations, and which you should get rid of. It. I'm not just saying, like, dodge left and right and follow the wave of the frustration and rage.
Like, weirdly enough, I'm a big proponent of something along the lines of, like, if you're a screenwriter or you're directing something or something along those lines, don't take into account anyone else except what you kind of view should be the end product.
I like that.
And if it sucks, then your idea sucked. No, it's pretty straightforward. There's no one else to blame except you yourself in that case.
Yeah.
But if it's good, it's because the idea that you came up with was your own idea.
Mm.
And that's what a finished piece of art should be. It shouldn't be like crowdsourcing art is something obviously that happens.
Yeah.
And like there's no way to disregard, like it's not like push it aside and never crowdsource art or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But don't build a product to appease someone else. Like create a piece of art.